This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
Iran's nuclear program heats up, Judge Alito answers questions, and who will replace Tom DeLay? Hello again, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, public radio's antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in the moderator's seat for our regular guest host and centrist Matt Miller, who's away on business this week. On the right, joining us from Washington, D.C., is panel regular Tony Blankley, editorial page editor of The Washington Times. With me in the Santa Monica studio is Robert Scheer, a syndicated columnist based at the San Francisco Chronicle and editor of the investigative internet magazine TruthDig.com. And from the progressive blogosphere, also in studio, is panel regular Arianna Huffington, editor of Huffington Post. Well, Iran has removed the seals on a uranium enrichment plant as nuclear negotiations with Europe break down. Tony, what's it mean?
Well, it means that the most of the world, the Europeans, British, French, the Germans, probably even the Russians and perhaps the Chinese, have come around now to agree with what the Bush American government policy has been, which is deep concern that Iran may move towards developing nuclear weapons and an intent to try to block it. The real issue is going to be, it'll probably come to the Security Council. Secretary of State Rice has called for it. I think she's got at least four of the five permanent countries other than China supporting the idea. The question is, what kind of sanctions will the Security Council impose? Will they be merely diplomatic? Will they be general economic, including trying to sanction sale of Iranian oil? Will they include attempting to block import into Iran of any materials, products, or services that might assist them in developing nuclear weapons, or would it in fact be military? I think the last one is, for the time being, off the table for everyone other than perhaps the U.S. government. And my guess is it'll be softer than will be necessary to coerce Iran into compliance.
Tony, just briefly, this is not the first time Iran has been in the news on this subject or that we've had this conversation. Why is the situation more urgent now than in any of the previous conversations about Iran pushing the envelope here?
Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, because the United States agreed the last time it started expressing concern to let France and Germany and Britain try to negotiate with Iran. France, Germany, and Britain have now agreed that negotiations have failed and they need to move into the next step, which is coercive diplomacy. And also this week, Iran broke the seals, which so they are now expressly and on the record going forward with a process that they claim is only for peaceful use of nuclear energy, but virtually nobody believes that.
Bob Scheer, let's get your take on this. Do you see military options looming on the horizon here, given the way the Bush administration has reacted in the past?
No, I agree with Tony on two points. I think it will be a diplomatic response and that it will be inadequate. And what has happened here is that the backstory is that the U.S. has reduced options. And the president on Friday, in the meeting with the German leader, said he's talking about, mind you, the rogue nation of Iran, the one he warned us about in the Axis of Evil, which now seems to be doing the very thing that Iraq was not doing, which is developing weapons of mass destruction, or at least the potential. And the backstory here is that we have to now talk about – I favor, by the way, diplomatic proposals to see if they work, for sure. But the irony here is that he has to walk in a very gingerly fashion here because the protégés of the government of Iran are the very people that he's counting on to give him his exit strategy from Iraq, because, in fact, the result of this invasion against a country that did not have WMD is to put the protégés of Iraq – of Iran who are in Iraq in power. And that very much reduces what you can do, your options of what you can do against Iran.
Arianna.
Yes, I actually agree both with Tony that we need to move to coercive diplomacy, as he called it, end with Bob about the importance of the backstory. You know, in Tony's column this week, he quotes Henry Kissinger saying that the advantage that historians have over statesmen is that historians know all the facts and have years to assess them. Well, there are certain facts that we now know, even without being historians and even without having years to assess them, which absolutely, incontrovertibly show how disastrous our Iraq policy was when it comes to Iran, how everything we did in Iraq has foreclosed our options and has made our position versus Iran worse. And the administration cannot get away without addressing that. I mean, I hate this kind of amnesia that falls over public statements, like the president today talking about Iran as though Iraq never happened. You cannot discuss the two separately, because all our choices about Iraq right now, the fact that we are continuing to be there, even though it is now so clear after the decision of the most influential Shiite politician to renege on his pledge to adopt and change the constitution based on what the Sunni demands are, despite what he promised the U.S. government before the election, it is now absolutely clear that this country is moving towards a civil war. The Sunnis are not being included in the process the way the Shiites had promised they would be. The Shiites are basically using the administration to get what they want, and our very presence there is fueling the civil war. So given that that's what's happening, our continuous objection and denial to admit and acknowledge the facts is affecting all our options in the Middle East, and especially when it comes to Iran.
Tony, I can hear you sort of chomping on the bit for this one.
Well, look, the question forward-looking that has to be resolved is whether the risk of Iran developing nuclear weapons poses a higher or a lower cost than the what I believe the only way of stopping it, which is military airstrikes plus some combination of either commando or perhaps armed incursion briefly, not to occupy Iran, but to make sure the destruction of the sites are complete. Which one has the higher cost to the United States from our point of view and to the broader world from other countries' point of view? And it's going to be a pretty close call, because the cost of using military weapons against Iran, particularly if it didn't have UN sanction, and we don't know that yet, of course, it's early in the process, would be at the minimum to lose further support around the world, to further inflame some Muslims around the world, and to run the risk that Iran would retaliate by the use of terrorism here in the United States if they can, and many people think they could. On the other hand, letting Iran have a nuclear weapon, they already have the intermediate-range ballistic missiles, and being led by a country that swears to wipe Israel off the map and denies the Holocaust, and their missiles can already reach Vienna, is also an appallingly high cost, and it's going to be a very hard judgment which cost is higher.
Bob, I'll give you time for a quick response before we move on.
Well, just it's so interesting here. The neoconservatives, I'm not blaming Tony for this, but the neoconservatives claimed that going into Iraq was the best thing for Israel. And now what has happened is, of course, the hand of Iran has been strengthened and their allies are in power in Iraq, and they're still threatening to wipe Israel up. I do want to say that we're in a weak position to tell people not to develop nuclear weapons when, in fact, we are the major developer of nuclear weapons in the world. And no less a hawk than Robert McNamara has been pointing out for years that unless we actually take a firm stand against the usability of nuclear weapons instead of developing ever new ones, we're not in a strong moral position. And I want to be on record here as saying I certainly want to give diplomacy a chance. I can't think of anything more disastrous than a military action against Iran now as far as just destroying any notion of stability in the Middle East.
Well, that story obviously will continue to unfold next week as the issue moves to the United Nations Security Council. But for now, let's look back to the confirmation hearings of Judge Alito this week. Arianna, what did we learn, or what did the process tell us this week?
Well, we actually learned, first of all, that, as we suspected at the beginning, Alito was going to be confirmed. So there was an element of sort of kabuki theater in the confirmation hearings. There's no question that Alito is a conservative. He's a conservative who believes many things that I find abhorrent. There's also no question that a lot of Democrats, especially Joe Biden, who used these hearings as another opportunity to grandstand and go on about himself and ask five questions in half an hour and talk the rest of the time, show how there has to be a better way to do this than these made-for-TV hearings, which took so much oxygen out of critical issues. I mean, trust me, this is an incredibly critical issue. This affects who is going to be on the Supreme Court. But it was very clear from the beginning that the Democrats did not stand much of a chance to stop him. And I believe, actually, in hopeless battles. I don't think that you should only fight battles you can win. But in this case, sort of, we are all left with a sense of what happened last week, you know. Why?
But should people have to sort of come out as they kept pressing Alito and say, this is where I stand on abortion? I mean, what if it was reversed, if it was a favored Democratic nominee to the Supreme Court who clearly was, perhaps had supported Roe v. Wade or been, believed in it? Should judges have to say, this is what I believe on cases that are coming before them?
Well, there is this assumption that you do not answer hypotheticals, you do not answer anything that is going to prejudge how you are going to decide on an upcoming case. But, interestingly enough, abortion was not the most front and center issue here.
I think
presidential powers and executive powers was clearly the issue based on where we are and what we are debating at the moment as a country. That was at the forefront. And there, I think Alito's views are extremely scary. So I'm not minimizing at all how important it would have been to try and stop Alito. But it was pretty clear early on that it wasn't going to happen.
Tony Blankley, what about the issue of the conservativeness of Judge Alito? Conservatives were quite upset with the president's previous nominee, whom he withdrew, Harriet Myers, as not being conservative enough for them. What do you think they're going to say about Alito?
Oh, I know what they're going to say. I've said it well before this week. He is, by every conceivable measure, a very solid conservative, and virtually every conservative is going to be delighted that his nomination is now almost assured. Let me just go back briefly to what Arianna was saying. While I think this result was close to inevitable, I think the Democrats misfired by spending the first part of the hearings trying to characterize him as a racist and a sexist, and the reason that was a mistake is because it was obvious he wasn't, so they weren't going to be able to prove it. I think it would have been more edifying and perhaps more useful if they have drilled him much more on his constitutional principles, where at least they could have established a deeper record. I think that they gave him a free pass for all of those questions about, did he or did he not belong to a club in Princeton, 30 years ago. This, I thought, was a waste of their time. They might have been able to have pressed him, and he might have looked more evasive if they spent more time on the substantive issues. But I think the result was pretty close to inevitable.
Robert Scheer.
Yeah, by the way, for careful students of the ideological wars of left, right, and center, I want to say that I supported Harriet Myers, and I said people would regret what came in her place. And the reason I supported her is, first of all, I assumed that when we lost the election, and I very clearly did not vote for Bush and voted for his opponent, and so I, as others, we warned this would happen. You're going to get a court that's going to reflect his views, and he was pretty clear about it. At least Harriet Myers understood what it meant to be a woman coming up in a male-dominated society. She had some sense of social justice. She had some sense that the good old days before the Warren Court were not great old days. She was a work in progress. And I liked her for all the reasons that people condemned her for. I liked the fact that she didn't have all the answers. She had an open mind. She was capable of learning. She might actually listen to these cases. And what you have now is an ideologue. And where I disagree with Tony, I think it matters a great deal that you think the Warren Court was a disaster. That after all, the Warren Court did the most important thing for human rights since the ending of slavery, which is the ending of segregation in this country. I think it does matter that you actually thought Princeton was going down the tubes because it admitted women and didn't follow the legacy code of, you believe in affirmative action for rich Princeton graduates, and yet you're against affirmative action. I think those are important issues. And I do think abortion is an important issue. I think the Republicans are in a bit of trouble because if they've promised a court that's going to ban abortions, the day you ban abortion, let me tell you, whatever the numbers are now, they go all the way when you start having people go to Tijuana or it's legal in certain states or you use coat hangers and so forth. I
remember the good old days before there was choice. And let me tell you, public opinion will swing very strongly in the pro-choice side once they win this victory. I don't think they want it. And they'll want rather exploit it as an electoral issue for the next decades.
We'll get back to some responses on Bob's comments in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Matt Miller, with panel regulars Arianna Huffington, Robert Scheer, and Tony Blankley. We've been talking about the Alito confirmation hearings this past week. Tony, let's go back to you for a moment on this question of, we were just hearing from Bob before the break, of the things that really do matter, the things that Alito didn't seem to care too much about.
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm not in favor of legacy admissions into Princeton, and not having gone to Princeton myself, my son had to get into Princeton last year without the benefit of my legacy, since I went to UCLA. So he had a tougher competition.
Fine public university legacy.
I'm not sure why Bob said that. I didn't think that the Warren Court mattered. Obviously, it was the most important court of the last century, and the Board v. Board of Education was arguably the most important case of the last century by the Supreme Court. So I'm not sure where he was coming from on that. But I was simply making the tactical point that the Democrats misused their time and could have honed in more on those zones that they thought ought to be elaborated on, the substantive points. And they lost that by spending all this time trying to prove something that was unprovable, which was that he's a bigot, because he's not.
Well, but Tony, maybe you can address the question, because what was most upsetting to me reading the whole history of your nominee was that he thought the Warren Court was a disaster. He expressed this point of view in speeches and comments and everywhere else. Is that not his view?
Well, but not because of Board of Education, which is a unanimous opinion. And I'm pretty sure, I would assume that he would have found a way to vote for Board of V Education, but for so many other rulings, the expansive Miranda, Arizona v. Miranda, so many of the criminal procedure cases. I was a prosecutor in L.A. for 8 years, and we were living with the aftermath of that. Subsequent courts had to fix an awful lot of that because it simply skewered the ability of the people to get criminals who were guilty into prison. So I think there's a lot of grounds for criticizing the Warren Court, but Brown v. Board of Education is exactly not one of them.
I just want to jump in for a second and say, as you're kind of in the midst of the fray here on Alito, could we just get a thought or two from you guys on the impact of an Alito coming onto the Supreme Court? There's been so much concern over the years about what will happen when there's finally a conservative majority on the court. How likely are we to see sort of these big changes? And just give me brief answers.
My hunch is that we need one more to be certain, but certainly a lot of the 5-4 votes are likely to go the other way. But I don't think you're going to see that many reversals. I think what you're going to see, particularly with with Roberts and the rest of them supporting him, is you're going to see limiting the application of precedent rather than overturning it. That's what happened on Miranda under the Rehnquist Court. They constantly limited its application. I think that's what you're likely to see on Roe v. Wade and so many other areas, certainly in interstate commerce. So it won't be revolutionary, but it'll be fairly dramatic over a period of 10 or 15 years in curtailing the impact and scope of the previous court precedents.
I think the real test for the conservatives here will be whether they totally abandon their commitment to states' rights, because as the federal government has been seized by what used to be thought of as the right wing, and Warren, who was a moderate Republican, is now considered a wild radical, it seems to me now, with capturing fully the third branch of government,
The test will be whether the states can take a more progressive view, whether it's on gay marriages or choice, whatever, criminal procedures, what have you. Those of us who live in more enlightened states will be happy for this, and we won't want those decisions overruled by this court. Unfortunately, in that first Florida dispute that allowed Bush to become president and do all this, the so-called conservatives abandoned their commitment to states' rights and states of obligation to run elections. So I'm afraid they will abandon that when the states become the progressive agency, at least some of the states, and the federal government moves further down the reactionary road.
Okay, let's leave the court behind for now. And Arianna, let's start on a new subject, the House Republican leadership, the ongoing Abramoff scandal. What have you got to say?
Well, this is obviously becoming such a major threat to Republican electoral prospects in 2006 that there was a really interesting piece in by Nina Easton in the Boston Globe in which a Republican strategist was quoted as saying that that with the Congress and the sort of impression of a very corrupt Congress being now kind of inevitable for the Republicans, at least the president will have to control what's happening in Iraq. I thought it was really amazing when they are so afraid of the corruption in Congress that they think they will have a better chance of controlling the events in Iraq.
So perspective.
Yes, I thought this was a really interesting department of perspective at the GOP. And there is no question that all that they are trying to do right now is kind of distancing themselves from Abramoff, considering him as the one bad apple, the way they did when Ken Lay and Enron happened.
How successful are they going to be?
Well, it all depends on what the Democrats are going to do, as always. And the Democrats seem to be taking a pretty aggressive stance here. It is clear that this is not one bad apple, that it affects an enormous amount that happened in Congress, that a lot of politicians, a lot of elected officials are involved. And it's also an opportunity to look at the whole system, especially the system of lobbying. And there are two areas that particularly interest me. One is families lobbying. I think the public really gets the fact that we need to put an end to spouses and children of elected officials becoming lobbyists. I mean, it's so widespread. You have Dennis Hatter's son and Trent Lott's son, and you had Tom Daschle's wife. It's bipartisan. It's across the board. And there has to be some very simple slogan, like one per family. You know, if a significant other that you're tied to either by DNA or marriage is elected, just get another job or wait until they leave office, because there's no way to avoid both the perception and the reality of a conflict of interest. And the other major issue for me is what's happening with the charities. You know, the way that charitable foundations set up by elected officials are being used by corporate interests and other special interests to game the system is another thing that has been exposed through the Abramoff affair.
Tony, let's hear your take from Washington, D.C. on what things look like for Republicans in the House.
Well, those listeners who were tuned in last week may recall that I pretty bluntly said this is going to be seen as a Republican scandal overwhelmingly and will substantially adversely affect the Republicans and very much puts in doubt whether they can hold on to the majority. So that I take as a political given. As far as the Arianna's statement that wives shouldn't be permitted to have jobs conflicting with their husbands, this is a pretty anti-feminist position, and she's not the property of her husband, and she has every right to take any job that she wants.
I think she was restricting it to lobbying.
Well, I mean, but that too. I mean, there are only so many jobs that are available in Washington. But the point is, why would you be able to restrict the wife's employment in any way based on the fact her husband has another job? But let me just go very briefly
but
to the actual.
Can I answer that quickly, Tony? Because the only reason.
Quickly, yes.
Yeah, the only reason.
All Linda, of you, quickly.
The only reason Linda Daschle has such a prominent job as a lobbyist was because of what her husband's position was, and there was an enormous amount of legislation involving American Airlines, for example, the bankruptcy bill when it came to the airlines bankruptcy.
Examples go either way, but take Mr. Blunt's wife, who was a leading lobbyist before he married her. But in any event, let me very briefly go to the actual election, which is, I think, pretty interesting. You've got Boehner and Blunt right now. You've got John Shattuck, sort of the pure conservative, getting into the race today. And you've got Bill Thomas, the wily, aggressive, and obnoxious but brilliant chairman of the Ways and Means, itching to try to get into it. My guess is right now is that Boehner will win, for what that's worth.
Okay, thanks. And before we get to the rants, Bob, you've got about 30 seconds.
I just want to be clear about one thing. There is no Abramoff scandal without a DeLay and Republican leadership, Tom DeLay and Republican leadership scandal, and no less an authority than Dick Armey said. DeLay sent his lieutenant down. This was the K Street project, DeLay's wife, and where nothing, it's not that the wife, if it was the husband, it would be the same thing if it was the son. The point is these people are given the jobs, whether they're wife or husband of the electorate, because they have the influence. Tom DeLay sent his chief of staff, you leave my office, you go start this lobbying firm, you hire my wife, you work with this guy Abramoff, you work with these folks in San Diego who are gaming the military system, selling them systems they don't need in the Cunningham, he's already pled guilty, case. Here these people claim they care about national defense and they sell this garbage that the military doesn't want, the inspector general says they don't need. And the guy gets millions of dollars to do that. And this is a scandal that goes to the whole illusion of the Republicans as caring about small government, honesty, and a strong defense.
But, Bob, I just have to say it's so rare that I get a chance to carry the feminist banner.
You were really enjoying that, Tony. I know you were just, like, ready to jump on that. Okay, it's time for our famed end-of-show left, right, and center rant with pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Tony Blankley, go on, rant.
I'm outraged. The Department of Agriculture is attempting to get around a bill that was just passed a few months ago stopping horse slaughter for human consumption. I was very active in editorializing in favor of banning that. They've now announced that they figure out a way around that, even though the will of the people has just been expressed by Congress. The bureaucrats ought to follow the dictates of Congress, not the other way around.
Garyana Huffington.
Well, I'm delighted that Jack Murtha is back, both speaking around the country and blogging for the Huffington Post and saying unequivocally that Iraq is not about the war on terror. It's about the civil war going on in that country.
I think the death of pilgrims in Saudi Arabia is another illustration of that madness, religious madness, the need to stone the devil, the need to get it in before nightfall, or you don't go to heaven in your lifetime. It shows the sad impact of religious fanaticism in the modern world.
Well, I actually get a little bit longer than the rest of you because we mistimed it a little bit here, and I don't have a rant as much as I just want to point out some interesting news that came from the state of Maryland just the other day. The General Assembly there overrode the veto of a bill that will force Walmart to pay more in health benefits. It's a huge victory for organized labor. The bill itself was not specific to Walmart. It was for companies that employ more than 10,000 employees and to make them pay more in health benefits. But Walmart was clearly the target there. The majority leader said that he felt Maryland should be the first state to stand up against what he termed the race to the bottom of companies cutting employee benefits to save money. Both sides think it's going to set a trend in the sort of battle over progressive employee health benefit issues in the country to come. And on my last note, I just wanted to say a word about, with all those who've been dying in Iraq, it's still a dangerous place for journalists. Jill Carroll, who was a freelance correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, which is my home as a newspaper, was kidnapped in Iraq this week, and there is no news about her whereabouts. And I'm thinking about the journalists there. So that's all the time we have for our rants today. Thanks, as always, to Robert Shear, Arianna Huffington, and Tony Blankley. The producer of this program is Sarah Spitz. Our technical director is J.C. Swatex, with engineering assistance from David Green. Thanks also to WAMU in Washington, D.C. I'm Sarah Terry. Matt Miller returns next week. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in for the next edition of Left, Right, and Center.
Pajamas.
I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we
know we need each other, so we
better call the calling of all.
audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.
You've been listening to KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Le Show, a weekly romp through the worlds of media, politics, sports, and show business with satirist Harry Shearer. Check out the podcast of Le Show at kcrw.com.